80 Sen, the Tokyo geishas who manicured the admiral's nails, called him. The rate for a manicure was 100 Sen, but Isoroku Yamamoto insisted on a discount since he had lost two fingers battling the Imperial Russian Navy. The naval commander who crafted the audacious raid that almost wiped out the United States Navy's Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor often spent his evenings playing poker and the Japanese board game shogi for high stakes. In addition to knowing the value of money, the geishas learnt, the old sailor had a shrewd grasp of strategy. There is no chance of winning a war with the United States, Admiral Yamamoto emphatically warned his superiors. We must not start a war with so little chance of success. Last week, China appointed bureaucrat Zhang Xin to spearhead a $150 billion effort to develop advanced computer chips using its scandal-tainted semiconductor investment fund, sometimes simply called the Big Fund. The odds of success, Zhang probably knows, are pretty low. The so-called Made in China effort, launched under President Xi Jinping in 2015, which was meant to free China from dependence on foreign semiconductor technology, has seen billions lost to graft and wasteful spending. But all the billions haven't bought is a breakthrough. Now facing new technology sanctions by the United States, together with the Netherlands and Japan, Xi believes he has no choice. Advanced chips are often described as the oil of the future, the fuel of modern economies. The sanctions condemn China to be a second-rate power. The admiral would have told Xi he is making the wrong call. Facing sanctions that choked Japanese access to the banking system and 4/5 of its need for oil and steel, historian Edward Miller has written, Imperial Japan felt it had no option but to go to war. But even as he planned Pearl Harbor, gambling a crippling strike would settle the war on the first day, Yamamoto actually advocated reversing Japan's invasion of China and severing ties with Nazi Germany. The colossal industrial resources of the United States, he warned, guaranteed Japan's eventual defeat. That's a lesson Xi's China ought to be listening to. Through the course of the Cold War, the West cemented its technological lead over the Soviet Union through a technology denial regime known as the Coordinating Committee for Multilateral Export Controls, or COCOM for short. The Soviet science registered many, many impressive technological achievements. Expert Slava Gerovich has documented the enormous progress made in computer science, and of course the country famously landed on Venus in 1975. COCOM made this progress extremely expensive. Every nut, bolt and widget had to be developed indigenously. Even though effective Soviet bloc scientific espionage compensated for some of these weaknesses, declassified documents show, stealing technology could not create the economically efficient and self-sustaining innovation system that the Soviet Union really needed. Among the concerns that drove COCOM's creation was the realization of the consequences of technology transfer. The growth of the Imperial Japanese air power was powered by, among other things, British technology and American machine tools. The increasing sophistication of Japanese air power allowed the country to bypass restrictions on the size of its battleships placed after the First World War. Though there were multiple intelligence warnings about the increasing sophistication and capabilities of Japanese air power, military historian Justin Pike has noted, racism led military strategists to underestimate the threat that these posed. Following the historic break between the Soviet Union and China, the United States became increasingly willing to let Beijing reach past the Great COCOM Wall. Tai Ming-chung and Bill Gates note that as China emerged as a major Western trading partner, economic concerns trumped national security worries. China gained ever easier access to state-of-the-art technologies in aerospace, material sciences, nuclear physics, and computing. The West even facilitated access to military technology for Beijing, seeing China as a hedge against the Soviets. Japan, for example, gave China access to integrated circuits, which were critical to missile guidance and tracking systems, William Toe and Douglas Stewart have recorded. Experts from Japan lectured technicians on state-of-the-art air defense systems and on the application of computers in military science. Israel also became an important provider of cutting-edge military technologies. Leading up to his election in 1969, United States President Richard Nixon had published a roadmap for this Western rapprochement with China. Ever since the revolution of 1949, the United States had denied recognition to China, seeing communism as a threat to its interests in Asia. This strategy was misplaced, Nixon now argued, saying that the world cannot be safe until China changes. Thus, our aim, to the extent that we can influence events, Nixon wrote, should be to induce change, and the way to do this is to persuade China that it must change. For a while this worked, but Xi's increasingly aggressive efforts to rewrite the structure of global power and establish China as the hegemon in Asia were also the outcome of that very argument. The Chinese president gambled his country's centrality to the global economy would insulate it from the consequences of his aggressive foreign policy. The story of the big fund, though, makes it clear Xi also made a bad bet. Well-connected tech swindlers proved adroit at siphoning off state funds into dubious enterprises. Genuine innovations like Huawei's Kirin mobile phone chips, on the other hand, were crippled by sanctions which denied it access to the machines needed to turn the chip design into mass-market products. And worse, China just didn't have the fundamental scientific base needed to produce cutting-edge chip fabrication machines. This frenzy of capital investment, political salience, and the nationalist narrative sounds eerily similar to the disastrous Great Leap Forward of 1957, which was about increasing steel production, scholar Elliot Gee has noted. Today, this new Great Leap Forward threatens to become a Great Leap into Nowhere. Following its invasion of China in 1937, Japan grandly announced the arrival of a new order in East Asia. Tokyo planned, it said, to perfect the joint defense against communism and to create a new culture and realize a close economic cohesion throughout East Asia. Following Nazi Germany's success in Europe, Japan became increasingly convinced the West would not be able to respond to a swift war of expansion. Japan could simply seize the resources it needed and establish a sphere of influence across Asia. If that sounds a lot like Xi Jinping's China, it's because it is. The hawkish figures who dominated Japanese policymaking badly miscalculated. Their swift resource grab led the country into a war which it simply could not win. Xi likely knows his billion-dollar semiconductor fund just defers his moment of strategic decision. Facing sanctions with more to come and a slowing economy, the Chinese president could just fold and walk away from the crisis he's marched the country towards. The same course, though, isn't the only one Xi has. He might believe the West will be unwilling to pay the gargantuan economic and military costs of a superpower war, simply to safeguard minor allies like Taiwan. Even if the West does fight, Xi might consider the price worth paying. China's economic growth, after all, is slowing and its population is aging, which means Xi must act now or lose the chance of global hegemony forever. Ever since atomic weapons ended the war with Japan, the world order has rested on the assumption that no nuclear power will goad another to the point of war. The war that Japan began in 1941, though, shows deterrence can and does sometimes fail. When leaders believe the alternative to war is certain defeat, they can take ill-advised chances. Will Xi be willing to sacrifice the hard-won prosperity of his nation for the ideologically driven illusion of greatness? The path to the last great war tells us we shouldn't take the answer for granted. I'm Praveen Swamy, and I'm National Security Editor of The Print. Thank you for watching Security Code.